Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, should we change state election law to make ballot counting faster?
And the pitfalls of mingling your work life and your spiritual life.
But first, Arizona has officially been called now for President-elect Donald Trump. And with votes still being counted, Republicans in Arizona have kept one competitive seat in Congress for David Schweikert and are ahead in the race to keep incumbent Juan Siskamanian his seat as well. And that so-called red wave holds true pretty much from top to bottom on the ballot in Arizona this year. The GOP is also on track to maintain control of the state legislature, as well as the County Board of Supervisors, the County Recorder, Quarters office. To the surprise of many, the former president appears to have built a broad coalition of voters here and across the country that include a sizable chunk of the Latino vote, some women, many young people, and the vast majority of men. Here to talk about what led to this in Arizona is Gina Swoboda, chair of the Arizona Republican Party. Good morning, Gina. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning, Lauren. It's great to be with you.
Okay, so you had some pretty big wins across Arizona this election. Of course, votes are still being counted, but looks like it pretty much from top to bottom on the ballot. This surprised a lot of folks. The polls did not look like it was going to be this far apart heading into this election. Were you surprised?
I was not, but I'm talking my book, so of course that's what I would say. But no, speaking to the voters, you know, we've been out in the community from the beginning, in every community listening, and people were quite unhappy. And Kamala Harris several times was asked, what would you do differently? And she said nothing. And so, you know, people saw no hope coming and they voted for the only option.
Mm. So there's one big exception to that rule in this election cycle. Democratic Congressman Ruben Gallego is maintaining his lead against Republican Kerry Lake in the Senate race. He's expanded it a bit over the weekend. It's not been called yet. But why do you think it looks like her performance in Arizona so far has not mirrored Trump's?
So we are still counting. I don't want to count the candidate out, but there are undervotes in that race. So if you're looking, the number of ballots that are cast in the presidential race are far outpacing the number of ballots that were cast in the Senate race. And the only reason that would happen is if people just did not vote. So, you know, people for some reason felt they couldn't make up their mind and just chose not to participate. So that makes it harder for a candidate. It's not over. I still think Kerry has a shot. You know, we have a lot of rural counties out. Cochise is out. But you know, there is a big differential in those two races in participation.
Okay. It's looking like the GOP will hold on to control of both chambers of the state legislature as well. And I want to ask you a question about what that might mean. There's still a Democratic governor for them to contend with, right, in the states here. And last session, the Republican legislature sort of went around the governor a lot by putting in, you know, ballot initiatives on the ballot, referring issues to the ballot. Those issues seem to have largely failed at this point. Do you think they will take a different approach heading into this session?
So we picked up seats. One of the things I'm most proud of in my tenure as the chair is we did coordinated candidate committees, which is the first time the Republican Party's done that. The Democrat Party did that very well. That's how they took two of those seats in LD4, and I've taken two seats back. So I've swept every swing district. It looks like we're winning all of them. So we're going to come in with more votes in the House, with more votes in the Senate. On the ballot referrals, that is one of the reasons we had a two-card ballot. So we should just, as a rule, try to avoid all that. But we passed, three or four of them are passing. So that was actually successful. But it would be far better for the people of Arizona if the governor and the legislature can come to agreements on policy where they can and try to pass things through regular order. It is going to be easier, I think, for Republicans to get policy through without kind of being in a situation where one vote can hold you hostage. If your own majority, you know, is a one-vote majority, then any one person can kill a bill. So it's hard to get to consensus with the other side and govern. Mm-hmm. Yes, you need to stay true to your voters. You need to stay true to your platform. But to me, governing is about coming to a consensus and advancing policy that helps all of the people.
Okay. Do you anticipate that happening with the governor in this coming session?
I do. I mean, I'm hopeful that the governor got the message from the voters of Arizona, and the message was, we want you to work with the Republican Party. That's why they gave us more seats.
Let me ask you about some of the ways in which the Republican Party in Arizona functioned this election and got some of these got into some of these demographics that they haven't reached before. You had courted Latino voters in rural Arizona, I know, specifically Yuma, Santa Cruz County, still went to Democrats, but the GOP picked up a lot of percentage points there. These are border counties, majority Latino. Tell us a little bit about the strategy that went into that.
Well, and thank you for that, Lauren. So the first thing is that the policies of the Democrat Party destroyed their own base all along the border. And the same thing happened all along the border in Texas. And you can see all the seats flipping. And it's because the communities that are on the border are suffering worse than anybody else in the United States. Because you share potentially an ethnic or cultural background with someone doesn't mean you want them to come into your house and trash your way of life and suppress your wages. And so I think the Democrats kind of presumed, hey, the open border, these are culturally similar people and they're all for it. No, people that are here that are working very hard, that have a family, that have a business, do not want their wages suppressed. They do not want their schools overrun. They do not want their areas having increasing amounts of crime. And that's what happened all along the border. So in Santa Cruz, for example, the Santa Cruz chair, Steve McEwen, who's a tremendous person for the Republican Party, worked hard to recruit candidates for the first time in a long time to actually run, and then spoke to Democrats because Santa Cruz is a majority Democrat county. Mm-hmm. And he went out and spoke to people. And I will also say in places like Santa Cruz, there was a serious corruption case, which I'm sure you're aware. Mm-hmm. And people from South America are very familiar with corruption. You know, a lot of Republicans use the word socialist. Socialist doesn't have a lot of meaning in that community. But if you say corruption, yeah. We all know what we're talking about when we're talking about corruption in the government. So I think that was a big deal. The first thing I did as the chair was put an ad on Univision that ran in every match of the Copa tournament, just talking about what Republicans believe in. I went up on Spanish radio. I was up on Navajo radio. You know, you have to go and listen in the community. And in all of the polling and all of the time I spent in all of the communities, both in the Navajo Nation, in our beautiful Latino American communities, everywhere I went, the issues were the same. You know, it was inflation, border, and in Hispanic community, particularly school choice. Hmm. Educational choice is very important in that community, and that's a Republican issue in the state of Arizona. People asked me about abortion. Abortion kept not coming up in the top five of things people were talking about. I think the Democrats leaned very heavily on that, and that's not the end-all and be-all of what motivates voters. Talk to them about inflation, the economy, housing. My lady, housing. People are getting crushed. Mm-hmm. If you increase the supply of the population looking for housing and you don't do anything about regulation to increase the supply of housing, you know, the natural outcome of that equation, as we were talking about math, is pain. Yeah. It's pain for the average voter.
All right. We'll have to leave it there for now. That is Gina Swoboda, chair of the Arizona Republican Party, joining us. Gina, thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Election Day was nearly a week ago today, and we still don't know for sure the winners in several Arizona races, including Ruben Gallego's race against Kerry Lake for an all-important U.S. Senate seat. And while Maricopa County election officials warned us this would happen and that, in fact, this is usually how long it takes to count votes in Arizona, our next guest says it is a problem that is fixable. Lori Roberts is a columnist for the Arizona Republic, and she joins editorial page editor Elvia Diaz this morning to talk more about it. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. So, Lori, there is a real and specific reason, right, that it takes so long to count votes here in Arizona. Tell us what it is.
Well, the problem is that we love our early ballot program. It's wildly popular. We've had it for decades. And in recent years, probably the last 10 or so, more and more people are dropping off their early ballots at the polling place on election day, mm-hmm. rather than mailing it in, which would allow for those votes to be processed and tabulated ahead of time, they're dropping it off on election day. State law says you can't touch those ballots until the next day. You can't begin to process them. And so when you have 225,000 people drop off early ballots on election day, ballots that you can't touch, you're going to notice that it's going to take time. It's always taken time to count these ballots, an average of 13 days, actually, right. Over the last 20 years. But we didn't used to have these close races, so no one really noticed within a day or so. Most of the races were called. But in the last 4 years, we've had very, very close races. And so people are watching and watching and watching. And yet it takes days and days and days to process that many ballots if you're going to do it correctly.
Right.
So that's the problem.
Right. So that's the problem. Then they can open those ballots. They have to check the signatures. There's a verification process. All of that takes time as well.
Correct.
You say, Lori, in your latest column about this, that it is embarrassing, frustrating, and ridiculous. Tell us why.
Yeah. Did you see over the weekend there was a map of all of the United States and every single state was red or blue. And there we were, this sort of beige color, because we're the one state that stands out as not being able to tell people who won our elections. Can you imagine if this presidential election had been close and the election was hanging on the state of Arizona? As of this weekend, we still would not have known who was president. It's not really acceptable, and we look ridiculous to the rest of the world. And beyond that, it opens the door for people to be distrustful of, why is it taking you so long, and what are you doing, and are you rigging the election? You're going to start hearing that already as we get final results in the next day or so, and we can fix that. We don't have to be that state.
Okay, so tell us what the fix would look like, and then I want to hear what Elvia thinks about this.
Okay, the fix is really simple. You simply say, we're going to put the early back in early ballots. You can drop off your early ballot until 5 p.m. on the Friday before the election. If you want to vote after that, you can either go on Saturday, Sunday, or Monday to an early voting place and vote in person, or you can come to the polling place on Tuesday, election day, and instead of dropping off an early ballot, get in line and vote the old-fashioned way. That would solve the problem. It may not mean that we'd have every ballot counted by election day, but it would give election officials a chance not to just be inundated in this paper on election night and have us be in a position 6 days later where we still don't know who won the Senate race. So I think we kind of do know there.
Okay. So, Elvia, do you agree that this is an embarrassment for our state? There are other races in other states that have yet to be called as well because they do something similar or have a process that also takes some time.
When I hear stuff like that, especially from the conservatives who could have passed the laws, the Lori, what we're talking about, then no, absolutely not. They're just following the law. And so, as Lori was saying, if you want to fix it, then change the law. There is another one that wasn't mentioned here, and that's the fact that, you know, Arizona doesn't require counties to check the ID of those dropping off their early ballots. So they can change that as well. But tell me, why haven't they changed it in the first place? And also keep in mind that, you know, workers, election workers had been counting ballots for 12, 14 hours a day, and they come into this election being dehumanized and being attacked. Like, who wants to do that job, right? You know, thank goodness it appears that they had enough workers and just the little detail about following the law. So it also tells me that people just don't pay attention. I mean, we have been talking about this for, you know, since Donald Trump started saying the elections were rigged, and they just don't care to spend a few minutes to understand how the system works and, you know, and to actually call their representatives and say, change it if you don't like it. Now, you hear a lot about, what about Florida? They do it. Well, Florida has different laws, period. As simple as that.
Yeah. So as Lori mentioned, right, like dropping off at the polls, those early ballots, they call them early lates, right, in political land. It's an incredibly popular way to vote. It's getting more popular. It also tends to trend Democratic and younger, those ballots, as we've seen in the last couple of days as ballots continue to get counted. Do you think, Lori, that there will be a good amount of pushback on a proposal like this from someone like Warren Peterson, who you talk to?
Oh, there's going to definitely be pushback. I think it was in 2019, former Senator Michelle Ugenti-Reeder reminded me that she actually had a bill to do just what I've been describing, though I don't know if it included the open balloting over the weekends. And it died. And she also reminded me that I opposed it at the time. And I looked back at it. And indeed, I did, because Democrats were concerned at the time that this would lead to voter suppression. We weren't having this kind of six-day issue then. And so I think in 2020 is when I sort of began changing my mind on this issue, and specifically 2022, when we saw a record number of early ballots dropped off at the polls, more even than this year. I think it was 229,000 that year. Mm-hmm. So that led Maricopa County Recorder Stephen Richer in 2023 to actually propose this idea. And again, it just didn't get anywhere. I think Democrats were resoundingly against it, and enough Republicans just weren't interested in the idea that it didn't go anywhere. But Senator Peterson has said he's going to bring the issue back this year, and he feels like there's going to be more interest in it given what has happened this year. So I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I guess we'll see. Elvia, what do you make of that? Like, do you think some will see this as disenfranchising?
Well, yes, of course. And that has been the narrative for a long time. You know, 75% of voters do so early. And there is another new law that we didn't mention. And it's the fact that if you drop off your early ballot, the election workers have to count that ballot physically by hand and scan the signature before they do anything. Mm-hmm. So that's another layer that we have to deal with. So there's that as well. I don't think anything is going to go anywhere if, in fact, you know, Governor Hobbs vetoes it. I mean, they may have enough Republicans to pass a bill, but, you know, as long as you have these other issues about voter ID and specific areas, you know, like in the tribal lands and Navajo Nation and where ID and so many other of the laws that we're talking about will, in fact, mm-hmm. Keep people from voting.
Yeah, and we have heard that many expect the governor to veto a bill like this should it make it to her desk. All right, we'll leave it there for now. Editorial page editor of the Arizona Republic, Elvia Diaz, joined by Lori Roberts this morning. Thank you both for coming on. Appreciate it as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, during World War II, a group of Marines created a secret code based on the Diné language to transmit messages for the United States. We'll hear from one of the two surviving Navajo code talkers.
But first, for the first time ever, we have five different generations of workers all at once. As lifespan goes up and costs follow, more workers are delaying retirement as the newest crop, Gen Z, enters the workforce. This has presented new challenges when it comes to intergenerational collaboration and interpersonal relationships in the workplace. In the show's newest series, we are shining a spotlight on the changes and challenges of this new multi-generational workforce.
This is at times something that I derive a lot of meaning and passion from. And at other times, this is the thing that supports me and pays for my material existence.
Why should I buy a whole second wardrobe to wear to an office building?
Tipping as a social practice is one that is inherently rooted in social difference and also, in many ways, class hierarchy.
We see this growth of people turning to gig work because they're not making enough money at their job or because the cost of living has simply gone up and their paycheck hasn't kept up.
A few years ago, the writer Derek Thompson coined the term workism, arguing that with the decline of religion, work has increasingly become the source of existential meaning for many Americans. Simone Stolzoff agrees, because that's exactly what happened for him. A former reporter at various newspapers and magazines, Stolzoff eventually got burned out on his belief that journalism could save the world and left the profession. Now, he's the author of a book called The Good Enough Job, which argues that it's critical to separate our spiritual well-being from the work we do. When I spoke with Stolzoff, he told me that for him, that means taking his pickup basketball games just as seriously as he takes his writing.
One of the great things about playing pickup basketball is that no one cares about how many words I've written that week or how many books I've sold. You know, what they care about is that I am a good teammate and I box out when I rebound. And so you can, you know, extrapolate to whatever it is that you care about in your life. It doesn't have to be a big sweeping gesture. Just some reminder that you exist on this earth to do more than produce economic value. And I think, you know, there's a lot of pressure in order to sort of monetize some of our passions or monetize some of our hobbies. You know, you can't just be a someone who likes to bake. You have to be a baker. And then your friends will tell you to open up a pop-up or start an Etsy shop for your crafting hobby.
Yeah. Well, it's so funny. You know, I think about the basketball example, like, you know, if you decide you want to play pickup basketball, nobody's going to say like, well, if you like pickup basketball so much, you should join the NBA.
Exactly.
And if I'm hearing you right, it's about treating the pickup basketball game the same way as you treat your baking project or your writing project, even. It doesn't need to turn into a book the way yours did.
Yeah, I think the goal is just to be present in whatever it is that you're doing.
Yes, that all makes sense. But there was one chapter in the book that I found very unsettling, and I wanted to talk to you about it. All of the chapters are fascinating, but to hone in on Brandon Sprague. Brandon Sprague is a former Google employee, and he eventually ends up leaving Google to take a job at an AI startup because, as he puts it, quote, it's just a job. And his whole journey made sense to me in the context that we've been talking about, but something about the fact that it was AI specifically really got me spinning out, and I wonder what you make of this. Because to me, the existential threat of AI is that it's going to automate away all of our work. And I had this thought that in a weird way, maybe workism, where you bring all of your humanity to your work, is kind of like the one thing that could save us from AI. So I do wonder what you make of that question, the role that AI is going to play in our work lives and how that affects all this.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the million-dollar question that so many people are asking themselves right now. And so part of my argument of creating a more balanced culture when it comes to work has to do with what can differentiate ourselves from the robots, quote unquote. You know, the research shows that people who have greater self-complexity, who have invested in different sides of themselves, tend to be more innovative and they tend to be more creative problem solvers. And in order to be able to think in that kind of way that is uniquely human, you need to be able to have the space in your days, in your weeks, in your lives, so that you can be able to put those pieces together in a way that no computer will ever be able to do.
Yeah. You know, for some reason, the thing that just popped into my mind is Mad Men and how Don Draper is always coming up with these incredibly creative campaigns that nobody else can even conceive of. And it's because he spends his afternoons and nights, you know, drinking and wandering in and out of jazz clubs and doing all sorts of ridiculous things that nobody would characterize as work. And I know that, you know, we wouldn't necessarily Don Draper say that Don Draper has good work-life balance, but there is this way in which, like, his humanity and his work are so enmeshed.
Yeah. Yeah, one of my first editors told me that if you want to be a good writer, you have to have a good life, you know, and I think that's true for many different professions.
So, but how do you have that conversation with yourself now that you're writing full time? Because I know writing is a great passion of yours. Do you have moments where you have to tell yourself, I love writing, but it's just a job?
Yeah, I think, you know, the biggest thing that's helped me is trying to create structural boundaries to protect when I am on and off the clock. Part of it is things like physical space, like I have a desk where I write from. I don't do anything else at that desk. When I'm there to work. And then at the end of the workday, I close my laptop and put it away. Part of it is more spiritual in terms of the boundaries of making sure that I am investing in things like quality time with my family, in things like exercise that bring meaning to my life outside of work. And part of it is just keeping work in perspective and thinking, okay, this is at times something that I derive a lot of meaning and passion from. And at other times, this is the thing that supports me and pays for my material existence so that I can do what I love when I'm not working, and making sure that I reinforce that neither is more noble. Every single line of work, even if it is a passion job like writing or being a radio host, has its level of monotony and tedium in it. And I think a more realistic, a more balanced approach to what work is and what role it has in our lives can free us from expecting our work to always be a dream or to always be a necessary evil.
I actually am glad you brought that up as an example, because I was wondering if I could ask you for some advice. Because you do write so transparently about your own journey with this. And I think a thought that I kept having as I was reading the book is I am extraordinarily grateful to get to be a radio host. It's truly what I wanted to do my whole life. But I think something that I struggle with is when it comes to my relationships outside of work, you know, my relationship as a son or as a relationship partner, I sort of view my professional fulfillment as a prerequisite for me being able to be worthwhile as a son or worthwhile as a relationship partner. It would not be worthwhile for others to invest in me if I had not first demonstrated the courage of my convictions or something like that. Is that the kind of thing that comes up for you a lot when you talk to people about this?
Yeah. I mean, the thing that came to mind was just a brief anecdote that I wrote about in the book. I didn't expand on it too much, but it was this woman, Liz, who was a public school teacher and a lawyer, and maybe like you, someone who derived a lot of identity and purpose and meaning from her job. And then she got a chronic disease, which influenced her ability to be productive, to even show up for work at all. And the thing that she told me that has really stuck with me is that she started defining herself based on her evergreen characteristics as opposed to her professional accomplishments. So she started to see herself as someone who was generous with her time or someone who really showed up for her friends. And I think one of the benefits of framing your worth in this world based on these evergreen characteristics is they don't rise and fall based on the market or based on the job landscape for, you know, radio hosts. Who are you? What are your values? And how can you make sure that you're spending your time and your energy reinforcing them?
Well, thank you, Simone. Simone Stolzoff, author of The Good Enough Job. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. State officials say they'll work with a tribal-owned firm to help bring broadband access to Native American communities around the state. The money comes from the Federal Broadband Equity Access and Development, or BEAD, program. And our next guest says while there's been a good amount of money set aside for this purpose, it's still not enough. Joe Valandra is a member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe from South Dakota and chairman and CEO of Tribal Ready BPC, which will be working with the Arizona State Broadband Office on this project. He spoke with my co-host Mark Brody more about this, and they started with whether it's possible to describe the state of broadband in Indian country within Arizona.
Well, there's 22 tribes in Arizona, and some are located close to high population areas, and those tend to have better connectivity. Some have taken the bull by the horns and made sure of that, like Gila River, for example. But many tribes are located in very remote areas, like White Mountain Apache, San Carlos, others like that, that have great challenges bringing modern connectivity to their communities. So it really spans the range from very good to almost none at all. And it's hard to generalize more than that, but it really is quite a range. And that's typical across Indian country.
Okay. So how significant do you think it'll be that you are now working with the State Broadband Office to try to increase and improve that situation across the state?
Well, I think we believe the way the state of Arizona does that, given that we're a Native-owned company, understand that perspective, that we can help explain bring people together so that they can take it or at least have the opportunity to take advantage of the funding that's available through the state of Arizona. And that will be significant, just that tribes know they have that option and that they know they have the ability with that option in hand to provide better service for their communities.
So you mentioned the number of communities that are in more remote parts of the state, and there have been efforts over the years to get broadband into more rural parts of Arizona. But it seems like at least as it relates to Native American communities, maybe it hasn't worked as well as supporters had hoped it would. And I'm wondering if you have a sense of why that is. Like all these years later, a lot of these communities are still in the same position they were many years earlier.
Well, I think it's a complicated answer, but I'll try to distill it into a couple of salient points, knowing that I might be leaving a couple of things out.
Sure.
The current providers, the universe of current providers are commercial operations. So it has to be economically feasible for them on some basis to enter those markets, to make the capital investment and the other long-term investments that are necessary to provide the service. That's not an excuse, but it's a reason. And unfortunately, when you look at the percentage of native communities with adequate service, I won't say great service across the country, Arizona is no different, it's substantially less. It's, 20 to 30% less on a generalized answer by community. And again, that's investment funds available to the tribes. I mean, tribal communities have a different view on the investment. It's a benefit to the community, but until you have the funds to make that investment, and it's substantial to bring high-speed broadband to a community, you're relying on the commercial viability of your area. And if you're pretty remote with relatively small communities, either clustered together or spread out as many are, it's a tough economic investment for a commercial company to make. So that's why it's very significant that the federal government and the state of Arizona have funds now to help tribes make that investment, so that the commercial viability of it is not the first thing. It's still a factor in terms of making sure that there's long-term sustainability and all those kinds of things, but it's not the first factor when there's federal government and state interest in making sure that those communities get connected.
What kind of impact do you think you can make with the amount of money that you'll have available?
Well, the state of Arizona has, over $1 billion that has come to it through the BEAD program. There's lots of competing priorities. We understand that. But we think by making tribes aware that they have access to those BEAD funds, helping the tribes understand what it takes to apply for those grants, I think it'll be a major, major impact for tribal communities. And the state of Arizona should be commended for, making this effort, making sure that the tribal communities in Arizona are included in that process.
You talk about competing priorities, and I wonder, especially for some of the remote communities where, for example, reliable electricity and housing and other economic development needs are so great, where does broadband sort of fit into the universe of needs that those communities have and, things that communities would like or need to spend money on?
There's a lot of first priorities within Indian country, within the tribal communities, in particular in Arizona. But I will tell you this, looking to the future, I think it's safe to say that being connected to the internet at the fastest possible speeds with the most reliability connectivity will make a difference across the board, in that it facilitates better healthcare, it facilitates better education, or at least the opportunity to connect into a broader universe of educational opportunities, as well as economic development. All those things combined, along with everything else you can do with the internet, help build an economic base for the tribes that then can help address the other needs, the housing needs, the public safety needs, those kinds of things.
Are there cultural considerations with any tribes in terms of bringing something like high-speed internet to their communities?
I'm glad you asked that question. One thing that's being talked about and has been for some time now is something called tribal data sovereignty. Now, tribes are sovereign nations within the United States. But one of the things that we advocate and we talk to tribes about all the time is protecting their data. So yes, there are issues and steps that tribal nations are taking to make sure that the data that flows from their community is protected by tribal data sovereignty, that the right permissions are given, the understanding of how the data will be used and when it'll be used and by whom it'll be used are important considerations. And we're making sure that the tribes know that and are aware of it and are working on it right now.
Do you find that there is consensus within tribal communities about how best to do that and maybe what the rules of the road should be?
Well, I think it's a process, because if your community's really never had strong connectivity or maybe not at all, You know, it's an issue that may be sort of foundational that you need to sort of build from the ground up. But to answer your question more broadly, yes, I think there is consensus that protecting history, genealogy, ancestral knowledge is a very important part. In fact, I don't think there's anything more important to tribes than protecting that and making sure that it's used and accessed in ways that are respectful and abide by the traditions and laws of each individual tribe.
All right. That is Joe Vallandra, Chairman and CEO of Tribal Ready BPC. Joe, thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm happy to talk anytime.
The presidential election didn't just cast its shadow over all of your conversations with friends last week. The entire world is, of course, talking about it and watching closely as Donald Trump begins making his initial maneuvers following his victory. Joining us now for a look at the initial reverberations is the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones. And Rob, let's start with the latest UN climate conference, COP29, currently taking place in Azerbaijan. The event has gotten off to a bit of a controversial start.
Well, that's right, because last week, at the end of last week, we had the CEO of the COP29, which, as you say, is happening in Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan. That CEO was interviewed on a video, and in that interview, he appeared to kind of open the door to new deals between the person he was speaking to and this state oil and gas company in Azerbaijan. And we should understand that Azerbaijan is a petrostate, and the UN has various rules about how host countries should behave. Well, this was a breach of the guidelines. So it began in sort of controversy. And I should say that the United Arab Emirates, who hosted this conference last year, were caught, if you like, or accused, if you like, of doing exactly the same thing.
Interesting. So these controversies becoming a bit of an annual theme, unfortunately.
Yes, and in particular because this year, 2024, is on track to be the warmest year ever. And that has, of course, turbocharged these talks in Azerbaijan as we go along.
Yes. Well, speaking of global implications, last week the U.S. election dominated the headlines, of course. But the international ripples are continuing to spread following Donald Trump's victory. Tell us about the current state of play there.
So if you live outside America, you look at Trump's re-election and you ask, what are the foreign policy, the U.S. foreign policy implications of this? And of course, the Middle East war, of course, we don't quite know how that's going to shake out now that Trump is heading back to the White House. But almost the more urgent one is Ukraine. And that's because, of course, Ukraine relies very, very heavily on military and financial aid from the U.S. Donald Trump has said in the campaign that he can bring this war with Russia to an end in a day. And indeed, the Washington Post this morning was reporting that he's actually had a chat with Vladimir Putin, something that the Kremlin has denied since the elections last week. And of course, if that had happened, then Ukraine would be very, very high up that agenda. So it's unclear what Mr. Trump is going to do when he gets into office and whether he can indeed bring this war to an end. And if he does, well, what concessions will have been offered to Russia, because Ukraine, of course, is very, very sensitive about this. It doesn't want to give up any of its land. It thinks that its actual, the word it uses is this would be suicidal for Europe, because it says that Russia won't stop at Ukraine. It will want to go further. So we're watching carefully to see what happens. But we feel that really there's going to be a lot going on around Russia, Ukraine, and Mr. Trump in the coming months.
Well, while there has been all this focus on the implications of Trump's election, Germany has quietly been going into a bit of a political meltdown. What's going on there, Rob? And what should we be looking out for as that continues to unfold?
Well, normally Germany is such a stable country. I mean, it's the largest economy in Europe. It's the second largest financial aid giver to Ukraine, for example, behind the United States. Well, just as the US elections were happening, what do we find out? That the chancellor in Germany, Olaf Scholz, sacked his finance minister And that led to several other members of the coalition government resigning. And so that led to Mr. Schultz saying, all right, then let's have a vote of confidence to happen in January with a view to having elections in Germany in March, 6 months before they actually need to happen. So basically, political turbulence and coalition infighting going on in Germany at just the moment when really Europe wants as much stability as possible because of the transition in large part in the United States.
Well, in the midst of all this turbulence all over the world, really, Rob, why don't we end with a bit of a lighter story that is nonetheless quite fascinating. There were two very interesting artifacts recently auctioned off by the auction house Sotheby's. One is a necklace and one is a very unusual portrait.
Yes. Yeah, so imagine a portrait of the British mathematician Alan Turing. What makes this so interesting is that it's the first picture by a humanoid robot to be sold at auction. And it went for about $1 million, which was about five times the pre-sale estimate. Now, the image is produced by a machine designed to resemble or look like a woman. The machine was called AI DA, D-A, and that rather confusing name was after Ada Lovelace, who was a 19th century mathematician. Yeah, but it's so that's a sort of fascinating thing that Sotheby's sold off last week. And this coming week, we have a diamond necklace that's 647 diamonds. It was commissioned by Louis XV in the 1700s. And when it was commissioned, it was considered to be the most expensive piece of jewelry in France at the time and possibly even in the world. But it has this historical association, which is that Louis actually commissioned it for his mistress or one of his mistresses, but then Louis died of smallpox and could not hand over this necklace to his mistress. His grandson takes over in France, expels the mistress from the court, and the necklace falls into the hands of a very, very senior nobleman in France. He wants to curry favor with the queen, Marie Antoinette, and so he offers the necklace to Marie Antoinette. And you might think this story has already gone far enough, but it's got one more it's got one more twist, which is that when the necklace is being handed over, it's handed over to an imposter, a woman who is dressed as the queen at Versailles, and it's quickly kind of ghosted off. It's actually broken up and sold in London and all this sort of thing. And some historians say that this incident, the incident of the diamond necklace, had something to do ultimately with the French Revolution because it brought about more anti-monarchy sentiment in France. So quite an extraordinary story all around this one necklace.
Wow. It sounds like a Merchant Ivory movie.
It does.
All right. Well, that is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones joining us this morning. Rob, thank you as always.
Great. Thanks so much, Sam. Thanks.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Few have lived a life as active, full, and turbulent as Peter MacDonald's. As the first elected tribal chairman of the Navajo Nation, he was once called, quote, the most powerful Indian in the USA, when both Richard Nixon and George McGovern tried to elicit his support during the 1972 presidential election. In a dark twist, MacDonald was later sent to federal prison on fraud and racketeering charges and also convicted of inciting a riot that killed two of his supporters and injured two Navajo police officers. He was later pardoned by President Bill Clinton. But on this Veterans Day, MacDonald is remembered as one of two surviving Navajo code talkers, a group of Marines who created a secret code based on the Diné language that helped the U.S. win World War II. KJZZ's Phil Latzman spoke with MacDonald last week during a visit to Mesa, and they began by discussing what this day means to him.
Veterans Day means a great deal, not just for me, but the entire America. If it wasn't for these veterans, and many of them never made it home, we would not have the freedom and the liberty and the peace that we all enjoy. So veterans across the nation need to be honored, need to be respected, and also they need some help in many cases. Many veterans out there still don't have homes, still don't have medical services that they need.
I know we just lost a fellow Navajo code talker just a couple of weeks ago. You're one of only, I think, two remaining. Do you feel an obligation to pass along your story?
Yes. Three of us were survivors last month. John Kinsel, 107 years old, passed away. It really feel bad about that, but of course, we're old. So there's just two of us still alive, a World War II code talker, Thomas Begay, south of Gallup. Thomas was on Iwo. I just saw him about 2 weeks ago, and he's getting old at 99 years old, but he's still right in there. He says, if there's another war, I'm in it. He says, hey, we need to do everything we can to preserve our freedom, liberty, and peace that we are blessed with.
Sir, you're a young man compared to most of the Navajo code talkers. And I know that's because you enlisted early with some help as a 15-year-old.
Yeah, the youngest Navajo code talker. I discovered that out of the 420, I was the youngest at 15. There are some that went in at 16 and of course 17. But I volunteered in 1944.
With no birth certificate, it was his cousin, a fellow Navajo code talker, who vouched for him. McDonald described how his mission worked.
Every battle, every landing, they always put up at least a dozen Navajo code talkers to land with the first wave, because the command ship wants to know with the first wave where the enemy fires are coming from. They give us a map to memorize. Mm-hmm. So when you land with the first wave, then you start reporting the gun location using the map back to command ship. They then use a code talker to notify either battleship or cruiser to fire on that enemy gun position.
Do you think people understand the Navajo code talker's role in history?
Yes, I do. Of course, we all didn't think much about it. We're part of the war. We're part of the weapon. So we just all did our part, every one of us. Even back home, little kids gather newspapers, and all of us working together, we cannot be defeated, no matter what.
That was Peter McDonald, one of two surviving Navajo code talkers, speaking with KJZZ's Phil Latzman. You can find this interview at kjzz.org.
All right, that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Happy Veterans Day to everyone out there. Thank you for your service, veterans. Be sure to join us tomorrow with much more. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Sam Dingman, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.